Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're doing our spoiler cast for Season 7, Episode 4, titled The Spoils of War. Aaron, this is kind of your thing.
Joe B wanted us to title this episode The Spoils of Lore.
The Spoils of Lore? That's pretty good.
So there you go, Joe. You got your wish.
Yeah.
First thing I want to talk about, I'm going to talk about this in the main podcast, but is a burning question about whether it's possible to swim in plate armor.
And we both came down on the side of no, essentially.
No.
Yeah.
And I found this video on Vimeo where this guy who actually has a full set of period-accurate plate armor that weighs approximately 50 pounds, and he wasn't wearing a helmet either, so it's a very one-for-one test for Jamie.
Has both of his hands. Yeah, not holding a bowling ball.
How would you describe... So this guy jumps into an Olympic-sized swimming pool with the aid of some divers and does some myth-busting. How would you describe his success or lack thereof?
I would describe him as sinking, drowning.
His conclusion was that a fit person that wears armor all the time would be able to swim short distances. I saw a man who immediately sunk and could not return his head above water, giving it his all.
Right.
So
me too.
I was actually kind of surprised because I thought that maybe like I, and I think judging from the if you put like Michael Phelps in this shit that he wouldn't get halfway down an Olympic swimming pool before he would all it's 50 pounds and
sure.
And the thing I didn't even think about is how much of that shit is actually on your legs and arms.
Yeah, yeah.
And
how restrictive it is to your movement.
Right.
And heavy. Also, there's no current. This guy hasn't just been in a fight for his life.
It's the ideal circumstance.
He hasn't been knocked off a freaking horse
right.
and plowed into a river.
Back first. So
yeah, there's no way.
Yeah, it's pretty conclusive. I was leaning that way, but this video, contrary to the guy's verbal report at the end, I thought it's very clear that this guy was fucked. No, he tries backstroke, he tries crawling, he tries freestyling, and he glubs within feet of every single attempt.
Yeah.
So I'm going to link that to this show notes, but that's a preview of something we're going to be talking about on the main podcast. There's another, because we talked about the fun little map Easter egg that they had where, you know, one of the popular theories about Jaime, the book only prophecy, second part of the prophecy of Maggie the Frog, where she talks about how fucked Cersei is in her whole life. She says that after all these things come to pass, the Valonqar will come to wrap his fingers around your throat and choke the life from you.
Yeah.
And the Valonqar translated as younger brother in Valyrian. And in the beginning of the season, when Jaime comes into the map room, Cersei is standing on the neck of Westeros, the junction of the south and the north parts, and it's called the neck in the books. And Jaime is standing on the part of Westeros that's referred to as the fingers.
Okay.
What's super funny in this episode, there's a scene where that Tycho Nesterosi or whatever the hell, the Iron Banker, is talking with Cersei, and they're like looking at the map from like a little, like a doorway. And you can see the way they staged it, the fingers of Westeros are reaching out towards Cersei's neck. So I feel like they're having a lot of fun with this map. And I wanted to point that out if you want to check out that scene again. Also, something that I'm not as convinced at, Tom J. from San Diego is the first of many to send me this HuffPost article, which essentially recaps a Reddit thread from 2 days ago, where they claim that the ghost of Catelyn Stark is walking through Winterfell. So if you want to see this, I'm gonna include this note in the show notes as well, which is part of the article that you can see on your podcaster or on the website. To this HuffPost article, but there's a scene where Arya and Brienne are sparring. Right before they do it, where Arya says, "Is it not true?" I'm paraphrasing here, that you swore to serve both of my mother's daughters. And as she says the word "mother," a woman with auburn hair and in a green Catelyn Starkish dress walks behind the big door of Winterfell in the background of the scene.
Okay.
It's certainly not actually Catelyn Stark. If you want to call it an Easter egg to like hint towards like some of the Lady Stoneheart stuff, maybe. But like, I feel very certain that that's not intended to hint towards an actual Lady Stoneheart or an actual ghost of Catelyn Stark.
No, I mean,
you saw the video, right?
Yeah, it might be an Easter egg, like at best. But there are so many auburn-haired people walking around. Like, I can name six of them off the top of my head. Like,
right.
There are tons of them.
Right. Also, Joanna Robinson, our friend from Cast of Kings, she writes articles for Vanity Fair. Did you see her article comparing the fighting styles of Arya?
No.
How she went through and broke down the fight that, like, the beginning of the fight was a nod to the swashbuckling style of Syrio. Then it shows her attacking, like, Brienne's weak unarmored points, where she learned from the Hound, because there's a scene where she tries to get the better of the Hound, and she goes to stab him right in his chest, and it just needle just, like, deflects off of his armor, and then the Hound knocks her to the ground. And then the ability, when she gets knocked down, that little swivel kick that she used to get back up, she learned from Jaqen / the Waif. I thought that was really cool that they blended, like, all those fighting abilities that she learned from these multiple tutors into that fighting style.
Yeah.
The one thing I really want to talk about before we get into the feedback section is they mentioned the Golden Company.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first heard that, I'm like, you maniacs, are you actually going to go for this? Because in the books, the Golden Company, of course, we talked about this a lot of times, they were founded by one of the Blackfyre Targaryens, who, after their failed rebellions, fled over to Essos and started this company. Aegor Rivers, called Bittersteel. His nickname is Bittersteel. The company's motto is beneath the gold, the Bittersteel, to give, you know, homage to their founder. But they've always, like, their whole thing is they're not, like, really consumed with money. It's more like they all collectively want to go back to Westeros. They're like Dany, only several generations older. They've been disposed. They got thrown out of Westeros. So they've been itching to get back. And they eventually hook up with John Connington and the fake, I consider him the fake Aegon Targaryen. He's claimed to be the actual son of Rhaegar that was spirited, that instead of being smashed to death by the mountain, got spirited off and was raised to be the ultimate king and warrior over in Essos. And in the books, he comes back with Aegon, or the Golden Company comes back with Aegon, lands in the Stormlands and starts taking over a lot of the big castles, and they're moving on to Storm's End at the end of Dance of Dragons. My question to you, or I guess the discussion I want to have, is by mentioning this company by name, is that just a wink to the book readers, or do you think that they're crazy enough to introduce this fake Targaryen plot for intrigue for Dany this late in the game?
No, I can't see that. What I could see is they become, like, you know, another force that we're familiar with, but maybe not intimately so.
Right.
Like, we don't need to know all of their background.
Yeah.
We don't need to know exactly how it was started and who's heading it up and everything.
How many there are.
Right. I mean, like, there can be a Daario at the head or whatever, you know, and essentially that's probably good enough just to show that there are forces that will fight for Cersei.
Right.
Or Dany. I don't know who the Iron Bank's going to back. But, yeah, I don't think they need to go that far into this story to make to make this new faction work.
Like I said, it's so weird because – and I've always tried to figure out, like, what the Double Ds were trying to do in their adaptation, because it seems like they really – things kind of went off the rails momentarily in Season 5 where they tried to get into the Dorne, the essence of the Dorne plot, but they just kind of did a half-assed job, and just kind of half-ass is the way you can use to describe everything from Dorne that's not Oberyn.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe they did that because they still thought that they were going to get the Winds of Winter, and then maybe, like, the outline of A Dream of Spring. So they're like, well, we're not completely sure if this Dorne stuff isn't going to be significant. And then they're like, well, fuck it, we're just going to do whatever we want. I don't know, because part of me thinks, like, just where I was too quick to dismiss, like, I thought it was way too late in the game to do the Kingsmoot and to bring in Euron, and now suddenly he's a prominent character. Like, maybe they are going to try to squeeze in a little bit of fake Targaryen intrigue because the other thing is, like, with all the fake Targaryens running around, it also has this in the book reader's mind. It is something that also introduced the fact that Jon is a secret Targaryen. you know, like you hint that maybe Tyrion's a secret Targaryen, that maybe this Aegon Targaryen is actually either a fake Targaryen or it's the latest version of the Blackfyres he's a Blackfyre Targaryen. They're trying to get their illegitimate branch on the throne. It just seems crazy to try to get in with only 8 episodes to go. But the double.
I mean, has there been any mention of that character in the show? Really?
No. I mean,
I don't even mean the fake one, like the real one.
Yeah, I mean the when Oberyn is listing the crimes of the Mountain, he talks about the fact that he kind of raped his sister to death and smashed their children's heads, and I think Aegon was mentioned there. By name, and that's always kind of like my litmus test. Like, if it's possible, can you within 5 seconds have a clip of someone notable saying this person, so you would know? And at the best, I think they can maybe get Oberyn talking about this kid's getting his brain smashed to jelly by the Mountain. And I don't know.
How do you ever prove that he's a fake Targaryen though? Because there's only one other Targaryen roaming around.
You get Maury Povich out there to do a DNA test and.
That's the thing. Like, he could claim he's Aegon, and that'd be the end of it, essentially. Like, he becomes Aegon de facto.
I mean, there's a crazy theory that I read the season before you started joining me on these spoiler editions, where that goes that Illyrio is, like, an old Blackfyre Targaryen, and Varys is actually not a eunuch man. He's his wife, and that Aegon is their son, and that they, like, you know, that yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that and there you're gonna the reveal of this is gonna be Aegon getting his hands on the actual ancestral blade of the Targaryens, Blackfyre, and it's gonna prove that he's a Blackfyre Targaryen, and it's gonna and there's also a lot more, like there's prophecies in Dany where, you know, she in the House of the Undying, she sees this like Mummer's dragon, which is essentially like a puppet dragon or a fake dragon, like a prop dragon you'd see in like a medieval style play, that causes like, you know, all these false banners to raise, and it's like one of the threats to her in this vision that she gets. So sometimes I feel like Aegon's only purpose is to literally check a box of a prophecy, like Quentin Martell. This is another book only thing. That was the culmination of Prince Doran's plot, that he had worked out in secret this deal with John Connington that they're going to marry his son Trystane to Dany, and then Doran would support the Targaryens when they came back to Essos, or to Westeros to win the day. But a lot of me thinks that Quentin only existed in the story to check off one of Dany's prophecies, which is Miri Maz Dura says, you know, you'll eventually be able to have children, and Drogo will come back, and you'll get everything you want when the sun rises in the west and sets in the east. And Quentin Martell, whose house symbol is a sun, literally went from west to east to go meet with her in Essos. And then he got burnt to death by the dragons, and nothing came of it, but... Prophecy, checkbox, ching, done.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, what is the purpose of Aegon in the story?
When the Mountains turn to dust, the Mountain was killed by Oberon, check.
Right.
When the seas blow away, oh, the Dothraki Sea is dying because of winter and it's turning brown and it's check. Like, that's like sometimes some of this stuff is literally just so all the prophecies work.
Right. So what's the purpose of the fake Aegon storyline in the books? I know we're not done with them, so
we
don't really know.
George from finishing the books, because he's got 30 of these things up in the air and he can't let any of them hit the ground.
That's the thing. So,
or he'll get all the shit we're giving the double D's right now for jetpacking.
Yeah. If it's there to like say, hey, there are fake Targaryens floating around, or maybe potentially other Targaryens out there.
Right.
We've kind of already gotten to that in the show, right? The Tower of Joy scene tells us that.
Exactly.
So I don't think that would be a necessary plot point to hit. To introduce a character like fake Aegon.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't think, like the Valonqar prophecy, it's not in the show, but
it would
shock me if whoever ends up killing Cersei doesn't fit the Valonqar mold, because presumably the books and the show will be... Aegon and Tristan and Quentin, some of this stuff... doesn't seem like it's necessary because the characters aren't in the show and the prophecies aren't in the show and all those plot lines have been simplified.
Yeah.
But
it's my guess.
My ears perked way up when I heard the mention of Golden Company in conjunction with invading Westeros.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Maybe it'll just be, like, the Golden Company comes over, and after they declare for Cersei, they're all like, fuck you, we're Targaryen, we're Blackfyre. Because there's a line in the books where someone's asking, like, Illyrio, like, why the fuck would the Golden Company back Dany? Because they're Blackfyres, and Illyrio's like, oh, you know, Red Dragon, Black Dragon, they're just all dragons. Like, they just want to go home, right? They don't even whatever. Give a shit. Yeah, you got real dragons. They're all about the real dragons. Like, there's not. And maybe it'll be, like, they'll have that plot point. It's like that scene. What was that scene in, like, Braveheart where you think, like, this Irish army's coming to, like, supplement the forces of Longshanks, and they all declare for, you know, William Wallace because he's got that drunk Irish Jesus Christ on his side.
Right.
It'll be like that. They're like, we're fucking Targs. Fuck you, Baratheon Lannisters. I don't know. Okay. So that's all my bullshit that I want to talk about. Let us get to the listeners.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was, and those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations, while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Hey, everybody, I want to tell you about how you can support the Bald Move at club.baldmove.com. you go there and you sign up for it and you get some special features. We added a fun one. There's a series we do called the Empire Business, which harkens back to our origins as a Breaking Bad podcast. What we do is we kind of go behind the scenes about what it's like to be in a podcast startup. We talk finances, we talk advertising, we talk business plans. And we had a fun opportunity that David Chin, one of the co-hosts of A Cast of Kings, one of the mega popular Game of Thrones podcasts right now with Joanna Robinson. He came on and we talked to like the nitty gritty of business, and he kind of interviewed us and we kind of interviewed him about like our different philosophies and our different forms of support. We had a nice conversation. If you like that behind the scenes stuff, you get that kind of bonus content when you join the club. We also have little shows we do like Quit Your Pitching, where we pitch fake TV shows to each other. We've got video feeds of all the podcasts as we record it. It's the fastest way you can actually enjoy our podcasts. We have ad-free feeds, so you never have to listen to me drone on and on about some bullshit that you got a supporter by. You got VIP access to forums, first-run bald movies, tons and tons of extra content. So if you can't get enough, you can do that. And most importantly, it supports Bald Move, because we couldn't do any of this stuff without the generous support from our listeners. So go to club.baldmove.com, sign up today, help us keep on keeping on, and we appreciate in advance any support you give us. As always, you can send an email to gameofthrones@baldmove.com. Try to run the feedback gauntlet and make it on the show. Kelsey T., with all the recent talk about Jaime, Cersei, and the Valonqar prophecies potentially coming to fruition in the show, it had me thinking about the other options. In a recent episode, several times previously, Yara specifically calls Theon a little brother. Could Theon be the one to finally kill Cersei and end? Things to consider? The show and the books have spent a lot of time on Theon relative to how his story has panned out in the grand scheme so far. The increased screen time this season may indicate his importance is rising. I'll take a contra opinion of that the reason his star is rising is because, for, you know, against all odds, Euron is pivotal to the plot.
Uh-huh.
So you got to have these Greyjoys are all being drugged to prominence because it's, you know, Euron's going to be some big thing.
Okay.
Second point, Cersei/Lannister/King Robert are responsible for Theon being shipped off to Winterfell as a child, losing most of his surrogate family in the Starks, particularly his figurative older brother Robb, and the Bolton's governing the North, and therefore his torture and therefore transformation into Reek. I have a big problem at that point because, yeah, sure, King Robert put down the Greyjoy Rebellion, so he was responsible for Theon being shipped off to Winterfell, but Theon's got no one but himself to blame for losing a surrogate family to Starks. He literally stabbed them in the back to support his father.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know about all that. And finally, the prophecy uses the word wrap about the fingers around Cersei's throat, potentially referencing the Greyjoy Kraken wrapping its tentacles around the lion's neck. Euron being close to Cersei this season could easily allow Theon to come back into the fold, perhaps to try to redeem himself to save Yara, killing Uncle Euron and Cersei in the process. What do you think about Theon, the identity of Theon being the little brother?
I just don't think it's like thematically satisfying or narratively satisfying.
Right.
Like, what connection does he have to Cersei?
And that's the thing, like,
that would be important.
This is borderline prophetically satisfying, uh-huh. But since the show has no prophecy, you're left with, it's got to be, to me, the Valonqar, you have to consider, it's got to fit the prophecy because the prophecy's in the book, and to the extent that the identities line up, they should line up. But it also has to make thematic sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't have the prophecy, then all you've got is like, well, this actually hangs together as a coherent narrative, right?
Right.
And Theon, like, he's definitely got the means and probably the motive. Like, you know, he's often like, oh, we got to go rescue my sister. So he'll be in proximity to Cersei and Euron. But
mm-hmm.
Theon's such a little pissant that if he kills Cersei, it would be, in my book, anticlimactic.
Yeah. Same here. I'm really hoping it's someone who either means more to Cersei, if anyone does,
right,
or where Cersei means more to them,
right,
personally,
right,
like that. That's more satisfying. But I don't know if they're going for satisfying on this, or if they're going for shocking, or if they're going for disappointing intentionally. I don't know, man.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I just it's anytime you stray around anytime you stray from the like the most popular theories, there always runs into problems. Like, okay, well that makes prophetic sense, but it doesn't, like, you know, who is Theon to Cersei, who is Cersei to Theon? And
yeah,
I mean, it would be, I guess, a triumphant moment for him, because, you know, Cersei's probably the most hated character other than perhaps Euron at this point.
Yeah.
You know, like the Boltons are gone, and
I mean, Joffrey's maybe gone. If I want to stretch and say he might do it for Sansa, like, I don't know. That seems like a bit of a stretch, though.
I would go for Jaime because of personal connection, or the little girl who's been praying about killing her since season two.
Okay.
Those are my, those are my 1A, 1B.
Or Tyrion. Tyrion could
Tyrion, but that's it. That's what I almost don't want it to be Tyrion, because that's what Cersei expects.
Yeah. I don't think she ever would expect Jaime.
Now, I mean, it could be satisfying to just watch Tyrion throttle the shit out of her.
Yeah.
So, like, as a, and this other things, you never know. Like, okay, let's say it's Theon, and I'm saying, well, it's going to be anticlimactic. I have no idea by the time they write it, by the time they shoot it, by the time Alfie Allen and Lena Headey go at it, like, maybe it would be something awesome, but I'm not seeing it right now. Let's move on. Josh F. says, Howland Reed, because I said that Howland Reed has not actually been called out on the show. He said Howland Reed actually is pointed out in Bran's Season 6 Tower of Joy vision. He's actually one of the only ones of Ned's party who is named in the scene.
Hmm.
Bran specifically says, that's Howland Reed, Mira's father.
Oh, okay.
So that... So my thing is, like, can you introduce a character, and I've got this litmus test of whether you can previously on it. Well, Bran pointing to someone and saying, that's Howland Reed, Mira's father, is probably satisfies that rule.
And then some other actor needs to step on the screen and say, I'm Howland Reed.
Right. Right. I mean,
and then you connect the dots.
Exactly. Yeah. Because we know Mira. I mean, they could even go back and show Mira and Jojen swearing loyalty on behalf of Howland Reed, which in season two, I'm pretty sure they did. So, I don't think Howland Reed's necessary. And now that we know Bran knows and he's already in Winterfell, it seems like that's the main contra about the Howland, because he's just he'd be an unnecessary element of the plot that doesn't need to be worked out.
How about Mira? What do you think is Mira's going from here? So she's on her way out of Winterfell, but is she on her way out of the plot? Out of the story?
No, I really still do think that she's going to be vital to getting Bran an injection of humanity when he needs it most.
Okay.
I don't know what that'll look like, because she has no talent that we've seen for greenseeing or warging. If she's going back to her family, then that would lead her out of the plot. But, like, it would not sit right with me if this is the last we see of her. Okay. Because it was, like, you know, I know that's part of the plot point, that Bran was kind of relatively cold and unappreciative, but damn, that doesn't seem a payoff for the character, for me as a viewer, you know? Sherry S., I haven't read any of the books, but I've listened to some of your spoiler cast after season six ended, and I don't think I've heard you mention anything about this before, but is there any significance to the fact that baby Sam is the brother of the White Walkers? Is he special in the same way that Melisandre found the King's Blood special? I've always wondered why Sam has been dragging Gilly and baby Sam around with him, when plot-wise it would seem more convenient to have them elsewhere. This question is probably ridiculous, but I've always been curious about it.
Well, hey, come on. He loves them. He loves them. He wants to be with them. He doesn't want to just abandon them up north.
Right.
That's one reason to drag him along. But that's an interesting point. I guess he would be the brother of at least one... White
of all
walking
the,
something
of all the
right?
Craster, like, White Walker bastard babies, he shares blood with them. That's interesting.
Right. My question is, like, are we seeing, like, a White Walker baby when we see, like, a spiky headed White Walker on the screen? Like, do they grow up super fast, or do they take hundreds of years to mature into what they the horse riding version? You know,
right.
I don't know anything about that. I don't know if that baby is maybe out there on screen and we're just not knowing it because it's a grown up.
Yeah.
But yeah, technically it would have blood. And maybe, you know, that's why they're taking Craster's babies, is it's some blood thing where
that's important. Blow your mind? I don't know if this will blow your mind.
Uh-oh.
This is a book detail I haven't shared with you.
Oh, no.
So in the books, you know, Sam brings Gilly back. She's got Craster's bastard baby.
Mm-hmm.
And simultaneously, Mance comes north of the wall, and he's got a son that is the same age of Gilly's baby.
He swaps him.
And John is so afraid that Melisandre is going to want to sacrifice that baby for the power of its king's blood, because Mance is the king behind the royal, that John decides when he sends Gilly away with Sam that he's going to swap babies. So he keeps
Gilly's
baby. I
got Gilly's a better solution for you, John. Send Melisandre away.
Well, at the time, Stannis is kind of garrisoning the wall,
okay,
and
yeah,
like
yeah.
John's kind of like in the situation where,
much.
You know, the only power I have over Stannis is his general respect of this institution.
Yeah.
And if it comes between him getting his king's blood that his witch woman needs and my word, it's, you know, it's not going to go well for me.
Sorry, I interrupted you. So he does what?
So in the books, you know, you've got Sam and Gilly with this baby with royal's blood. And, you know, Sherry's asking me whether this baby with royal or like some kind of blood connection. I almost wonder if since these characters have kind of been like that. It's like whatever happens with Sam's baby and whatever with Mance's baby in the book, it's possible that both of these characters have been rolled into Sam's child. So I actually think that lends Sherry's theory more support. I've never thought of it, but like it is cool that like, yes, this baby has a shared connection to both royalty, to the others. And that's interesting because the connection to royalty is in the books, not the show. The connection to others in the show, not the books yet.
Oh, okay.
Right, because we haven't seen in the books the scene where they take this baby and touches the cheek and it cracks into ice and eyes turn blue and it turns into another. So maybe not as ridiculous as you think, Sherry.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to just drop that, how the books and the show might be converging there a bit. Mike from Louisiana. I think it's highly doubtful that Gurm will finish his last two novels. Can either one of you envision a situation where he sells the intellectual property to a company or publishing house and another author finishes the series and possibly beyond? If this occurred, would you be satisfied? I bring this up because George Lucas completely fell off the rails with the Star Wars prequel trilogy and Disney took it off his hands and they are taking the series to awesome places. Maybe A Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones is now beyond Gurm's ability, time, or interest. If that is the case, someone else should continue the work.
I don't think in his lifetime he would sell it.
He seems, even like in the last year or two, to be dead set against doing the like Brian Sanderson route.
Yeah.
Like just farm this. Here's my plot outlines. Untie my Gordian knot.
Right.
And bring this thing home.
He doesn't want to like, Robert Jordan it.
Yeah. Like because... I mean, we could sit and psychoanalyze George Martin all day long, but I think, and the key thing that I think of George Martin since his first three books, you know, Game of Thrones, Storm of Swords, Clash of Kings, I think the key thing that you could say is that he's delusional about his writing ability. Because, you know, when HBO made this deal in 2007, he's like, oh yeah, I'll have the next book out. And then the next two will just come right out. And, like, and he's been like, even in season three, he's like, I feel confident that I'll be able to outpace the series. Like, yeah. So when he says, as long as I draw breath, I'm not going to give this to another author. Or even beyond that, he's like, you know, like, I won't even let like my estate sell this off. I feel like he means it because he just, in his mind, is still going to bring this thing to an epic conclusion.
Yeah. No, it's interesting,
age,
though, because
his health, all that be damned, he's going to do it.
I do know that he's also said he feels some kind of responsibility, like an obligation at this point, to write the best possible version of these books. And he might not get there just from a time perspective, but like once you're dead and
the books aren't
written, how could you say nobody else ever touched this? I want to leave this work unfinished as opposed to having a conclusion, whatever that conclusion is.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
How about this? You leave a clause in your will that says, when the next fantasy author to write 3 to 5 number one best-selling New York Times hits comes along, let them do it.
Right.
Like, they get the reins.
Right. Whoever can pry the keep my laptop with WordPerfect version 7 out of my fingers of my corpse will be the next author of The Song of Ice and Fire. I don't know. It's the thing is it seems like he'll have to have a change of heart, which may or may happen. He'll have to go to his grave not finishing the books. And then, as it stands, like one of his Descendants would have to crack under the pressure of Disney giving them $2 billion or something.
Right.
Now, that last one is likely, but I don't know how I'd feel about it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, on the other hand, it's like I'm a secular atheist, so dead people don't give a shit. Like, it really doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. However, I'm also sentimental enough that I do think you should respect someone's last wishes if you respect them and their legacy.
Sure.
So, like, as a fan of George Martin and The Song of Ice and Fire, I don't know how I'd feel about just a theoretical, blood relative that does. I don't think Martin has kids. Does he?
I don't know.
I don't know anything about his personal life. He's married. He lives in Colorado. He has a theater. He doesn't write hardly at all.
He has a swimming pool. I know that much.
He doesn't average chapter a month.
Nope.
So I don't know. I have mixed feelings about it either way.
I can't imagine, like, oh man, if he has it in his will that you can never sell this thing.
Right.
I don't know how that holds up because eventually Disney's wishes be damned, copyright will expire on this thing.
Right.
And somebody's going to finish it.
Yeah.
The other thing is, if you really wanted to screw people and say, it's like, okay, there's a clause in my will that says my estate can't sell this.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be like, there's a clause in my will that says if I don't finish this before I die, J.K. Rowling gets it or something.
Like, I mean, why are you laughing? That seems like both things you could do in a will.
Right. No, you could totally do it, but it's like just this fuck you to the fans. Like,
I see. Fans, you think want the fans a conclusion would be to this. Outraged at J.K. Okay. I'm not even sure that's true.
Really? You think they would want the Harry Potter author finishing these
Rowling's
books?
J.K. Rowling's written other things than Harry Potter.
I know, but it seems like...
Under pseudonym, sure, but...
I don't know.
Maybe you would go, like, maybe you go with to Twilight. Like, if you wanted to really do, like, Twilight. Yeah. Like, Stephanie Myers is the only one that can really tell the beautiful, intricate Song of Ice and Fire.
And then it's just like this fucking ticking time bomb, right? Like, as soon as I die, she gets the reins.
Right. Right.
Well, finish these books, George.
Yeah. You've got, like, millions of fans donating to keep his lifeless husk on life support. Because as long as his heart's beating, you can't have it, Myers.
And he signs a do not resuscitate. It's like...
It's a shit show. It's a Game of Thrones.
It would be trolling the entire world.
Maybe that's his actual magnum opus. He wants to create, like, this Game of Thrones War of the Five Authors over his deathbed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there's going to be a scramble
for it. If he chokes on pork... Then I'm gonna say that's how he dies, and I'm
if he's murdered
as hell
at a dinner by Brandon Sanderson,
right, yep.
His throat slit.
Yep, I wanna like if yeah, I wanna see where Nikolai was. You know, what is he sleeping with his wife? Like, what's everyone's a suspect at that point?
Yep.
Oh. All right, George, just finish it before you... Can you do that for us all? That would make all these questions moot.
Mm-hmm.
Olaf W., just listened to your spoiler podcast last week where you're talking about Jon having the rest of Stannis' fleet. He also must have the Manderly fleet, which is presumably quite intact. If the Manderlys is anything similar to the books, they should have a good amount of ships, and Lord Manderly is currently present at Winterfell. So, book background, before Rob died, one of the things he ordered, the Manderlys is actually a southern house from a few centuries ago that was driven out of the south for some political reason. They backed, maybe they backed a wrong horse in one of the Blackfyre rebellions. I don't have that at my fingertips, and I tried to retrieve it, and my brain said, fuck you, pal. You got too much perfume shinchel information in there. Had to squeeze it out. But they're the wealthiest house of the North. They own White Harbor, which is like a big shipping hub, and they also have the largest fleet.
Huh.
And before Rob died, he ordered them to start building, like, hey, we're going to need a navy to make this war work. Let's build it up. And Manderly has been building this big fleet in secret.
Would you say 1,000 ships, perhaps?
Up to 1,000 ships that he's been building in kind of semi-secrecy as part of, like, you know, this goes back to the whole Grand Northern conspiracy theory. None of that's true in the books, and, like, or none of that true. I'm sorry, none of that's true in the show, and, like, if it turns out that some northern lord just comes up riding the Jon and says, I've got 500 ships that I've been building because your brother told me to, like...
Yeah.
especially on the back of Euron, that's already kind of started breaking people's suspension of disbelief. I just don't think it's going to happen, man. Mm-hmm. And now in the books, I imagine it would be a part of something, but in the show, they just fucking don't care. Like, how many guys we got? Oh, about 10,000. How many boats we got? About 1,000. How many Dothraki got? About 100. Everything's just like whole numbers and very loosey goosey. I don't see it happening, Olaf. Don't see it happening. Chris G. I've heard a few times that the Mad King might have taken liberties, quote-unquote, with Joanna Lannister on her and Tywin's wedding night, thus resulting in Tyrion the Targaryen. However, Jaime and Cersei are older than Tyrion. Wouldn't that conception have resulted in the older siblings? This would explain their incestuous relationship that is common with Targaryens and possibly Cersei's use of wildfire. Okay, so there's a lot of things going on here. Number one, of course there's a theory that says that Jaime and Cersei are the illegitimate children of the Mad King, Aerys Targaryen, and Joanna Lannister. Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Okay.
That's a whole other branch of crazy theory, all right?
Awesome.
But there's a lot more to this, and what's interesting is that George threw a lot of gas on the fire when he wrote the World of Ice and Fire encyclopedia, because he wrote a lot of these words himself. Others were like his notes that people kind of fleshed out and put in an in-universe kind of style. But he goes out of his way to mention, to reaffirm the many rumors of these liberties that were taken on the wedding night of Joanna Lannister. But they also mention the fact that the Mad Queen, or the Mad King's Queen, took Joanna Lannister as like her personal retainer or her lady-in-waiting. And she was then dismissed from her service without any explanation given. So a lot of people, part of this theory is it's not that Aerys like necessarily raped Joanna, but it's more that they actually had some sort of a love affair going that spanned this course of several years, might have even predated Tywin.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also mention that Joanna Lannister, like she rarely made appearances in King's Landing after she got dismissed. But the World of Ice and Fire also mentions that she did make an appearance at King's Landing, the rare Joanna Lannister appearance at King's Landing, where Aerys talked a whole bunch of shit about how her breasts have gone to shit because she breastfed her twins.
Jesus.
And a year later, Tyrion shows up.
Okay.
So the story goes is that Mad King Aerys negged her. Mm-hmm. You know, had her feeling bad about her boobies, mm-hmm. If I can use a technical term, and then use that to jump in bed with her one last time, and then Tyrion is born.
Hmm.
Like I said, there, and the question is like, you know, I explored with Kim last week on the podcast is, if it was never intended or it's impossible for Tyrion to be a secret Targaryen, why is George going out of his way to make sure these timelines could line up for this theory? Is it all smoke? Is it camouflage? Is it a red herring? Is it something that he thought about in the first draft of Game of Thrones and then later abandoned because he's like, shit, too many secret Targaryens? Will there be 20 secret Targaryens in the final version?
Yeah.
Who knows? But it is... You're right and you're wrong, Chris. The timing lines up for Jaime and Cersei, but also George has backwards made the timeline fit for Tyrion too, and you got to ask why.
While we're kind of talking about George Martin and whether or not he's going to write these books, do you feel like he's maybe doing kind of the hardest core fans a service by doing all this other writing in the meantime? Like when he's putting out these books, they're sort of ancillary to the main story of Game of Thrones or A Song of Ice and Fire.
Yeah.
Do you think that's his idea of like, I'm going to service the hardest core of fans by filling in some blanks, by giving them more juice for speculation?
If that's his thought.
I mean, is that satisfying in any way to you?
I don't think it's working because like it seems like a 99% of the fans, whenever he announces he's – like there was a lot of uproar. Like I think people – they have a love-hate relationship with this World of Ice and Fire. And on one hand, it's an awesome resource for world building. And,
right.
But on the other hand, like George wrote like, I don't know, 30,000 words for it. And he's editing this other pod, these things.
Yeah.
And he's doing these anthologies and stuff that has nothing to do with A Song of Ice and Fire. That like, and you also got to ask yourself, like, you know, in between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, if George said, hey, I'm going to do the Star Wars Christmas special, I'm going to do the fucking Ewok ABC special. I'm going to do Tales
right, but
of
those
the
are all terrible examples of but cinema.
What I'm saying is, like, I don't think that anyone would be. And that's the other thing is, like, I like Dunkin' Egg for what it is, but it ain't mm-hmm. no fucking Game of Thrones.
I mean, I it's look no at it Song and I say, and I wonder if he's not trying to create, you know, this larger work that's more epic and spans more centuries and more of a story before he kind of puts a cap on Game of Thrones or Song of Ice and Fire and says, because he runs the risk if he finishes the book of losing everybody else, right?
Like, right.
Okay, we're done with this story. Now let's move on to the next thing.
Right.
Maybe while he's got him, he's trying to create this larger fiction.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that I think the problem is the more he writes about this world and the more, like, the more chains are on him because these are things that are now immutable canon and cannot be changed.
Sure.
Like, if he just told the damn story and then elaborated, but now by elaborating, he's further limiting what he can do and what the fans' expectations are. So
that's true.
Like, it could be a possible motivation. I'm saying it doesn't seem like it's working. Like, none of the fans would be like, yeah, we would trade all this Dunkin' Egg shit and all the World of Ice and Fire and all the cookbook of Westeros for Winds of Winter right now, and also our firstborn children right now. So anyway, let's move on to Hagu P. In the last episode, you discussed if Jaime / Olenna's widow's wail was a foreshadowing moment. In my opinion, Jaime killing Cersei would not qualify, but Jaime making Cersei a widow again by killing her husband Euron would. You don't tug on Superman's cape, and you don't get too many two good hands and finger in the butt jokes to someone like Jaime Lannister.
Yeah, but they'd have to win the war for that to become a reality, right? And I don't see them winning this war.
Yeah. Yeah, or wait, maybe Cersei gets desperate. Like, after this reversal, like, Euron's like, you're in no position to make me wait, and they get married. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, I don't know about all this. I do think that, because that's the thing with the Double Ds, is sometimes, like, I like the Double Ds. I think they're pretty good showrunners. They're really good at adaptationists, but sometimes they're a little simplistic in that. So these jokes at Jamie's expense might just be to get us to hate Euron.
Sure.
And there's no going to be like it's not on Jamie's radar that he has to fucking defend his sister's honor from Euron or something like that. So sometimes these things can just, like, Bronn had this weird love affair with the bad pussy. And people were thinking, like, oh, this season, that's going to, oh, Bronn's going to, and oh, they're going to be on two sides of the war, and what's it going to, didn't mean shit. That was just a shitty, like, some of the shittiest writing you've ever seen just for a bad pussy joke.
She's still alive, though. Maybe he's going to go in from the dungeons and save her or something.
Oh.
She's the one left.
That would be funny if she's, like, on her death door and he rides in and gives her some kind of true love's kiss.
It's because
he's got the antidote on the chapstick on his lips.
Right.
Don't think
he comes
it's gonna
out
happen,
with
Jim
the,
Jones.
The big pink lips, like Cersei style.
Yeah. Oh, all you want is my hot lips. And I just want your bad pussy. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
No, I never liked it. Still don't.
All right. Kate from Sydney. As you well know, Gurm has been inspired by a lot of historical events when writing A Song of Ice and Fire, but one historical period's influence is more pronounced than others. Are you guys ready? We're going to talk about the War of the Roses.
Yep.
The conflict between the House of York and the House of Lancaster in 15th century England. The parallels are obvious, Starks and Lannisters, but if you look at the conclusion, there might be a hint of how Gurm could draw inspiration for the bittersweet ending of the series that he's always teased.
Mm.
Looking at where the pieces in the Game of Thrones currently stand, Jon and Dany may need a way to reunite. We all know that alliances are often cemented by marriage. But Jon and Dany related, they might need to take a look at other marriage options. What better option than the marriage that already exists and was referenced in Episode 3 between Tyrion and Sansa? The War of the Roses ended with a new house, the Tudors, arising from the ashes of both houses and famously forming a new house sigil that combined the white and red roses of York and Lancaster houses. Could the bittersweet ending see Tyrion and Sansa ruling together, uniting the North and the South after everyone else falls in battle? It also fits with the Gurm loving Tyrion the most because it's the closest character to himself. I always thought Sam was the Mary Sue for Gurm. Tyrion's like trying to fly too close to the sun. So I actually thought that was pretty thought-provoking because it seems harder and harder for me to believe that the two main heroes of A Song of Ice and Fire thus far are going to make it through unscathed or even alive at all. And it would also be cool that, like, Sansa and Tyrion, who have been groomed for leadership the most. Well, I mean, putting aside Dany and Jon,
officially,
yeah, it would be kind of it would be kind of cool for them to. Now, I wonder how they would like the red and white roses of the land. It's interesting. Yeah, I mean, how would you combine the wolf and the lion?
Are they just a wolf with a big flowing blonde mane? That's the sigil.
The house words is the seed is not so strong. Do you think that another t-shirt idea?
There you go.
Another t-shirt, wolf with the blonde wig, the seed not so strong. What do you? Oh man. Now I'm seeing like with the perfect because you know like look at the like whatever the queen's shield. It's like a lion and a unicorn like prancing on a something. Like why couldn't the lion and the wolf be like kind of like both like prancing on a larger shield that represents all of Westeros or the constitutional monarchy that Sansa and Tyrion will establish.
What's the universal symbol for constitutional monarchy?
It's a golden crown with prestige coming off of it.
I guess so.
I like it though. I like it.
Yeah, I really do think either
it really goes back to the War of the Roses roots too.
It does. Yeah, that's true. But I could also see, you know, that Tudor sort of thing applying to Dany and Jon coming together and saying, okay, we're no longer like Targaryen or Stark or Snow or whatever. We're going to form this new sigil, this new house.
Yeah. Again, going back to the War of the Roses, then that gets away from the Yorks and Lancasters because now you've got this other Targaryen that is not a York or a... But, I mean, that's just things like... Just because it's based on the War of the Roses does not mean it's like, you know, obviously there's no shadow babies in the War of the Roses.
Sure. Yeah. No dragons.
No dragons that I can recall.
Uh-huh.
So, but it's that's
there were whites,
super
though.
Solid there, Kate.
There were a lot of whites.
Always. Always. Yeah. You got to watch those bears. Even today, and you get off the beaten path in England, you come across a barrel right, ruin your day.
Yep.
Ruin your day. Werewolves too.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a documentary about that once.
Yep.
Some American lads that had a mix up with some of those guys, and it just went bad, went poorly for them.
Mm-hmm.
Gabe in Boulder Creek, Colorado. Can you guys explain to me exactly who owned the dagger that was used by the Cat's Paw to kill Bran? I know Joffrey supposedly hired the assassin to impress his quote-unquote dad, but I don't remember who actually owned it before. Was it Littlefinger or Tyrion's, and how did Joffrey come to be in possession of it? Boy, you made me do a shit ton of research here with this question, Gabe.
I have the same question, so I'm glad it came up.
Okay. So, the actual factual history, as far as I can tell, is that King Robert won the dagger from Peter Baelish during the tourney on Joffrey's birthday. So, the problem is the chain of custody that you go through here. Because we know, like, because there's some people remembering that, like, Robert was during the feast after the tournament, he was, like, cutting his meat and showing off teasing Littlefinger about it.
Mm-hmm.
And what also muddies the water is that Littlefinger himself tried to implicate Tyrion because he was fomenting chaos so he could climb up the rungs of power. But the chain of custody goes that, like, so Peter had it, and how he got it, not sure. But that's where interest the story. Robert wins it off of a bet. Littlefinger tried to make it seem like Tyrion, he won it from Tyrion because he bet against his brother Jaime and he bet Sir Loras to win. And Jaime, in I think the second book when he's talking to Cat Stark about it, he's like, yeah, sure, I threw your son out the window, but Tyrion would never bet against me in any fucking duel, especially for Sir Loras, which is the first kind of piece of doubt that's cast on it. And then Tyrion is simultaneously investigating this, and there's several other conversations, like Jaime and Cersei talk about it, and Tyrion wonders about it, and then Tyrion goes and talks to Jaime about it. And since we know that Robert owns it, the thing that Tyrion, Jaime, and Cersei seem to agree on is that Joffrey overheard Cersei and Robert talking about what a shame it was that Bran is going to live his life as this vegetable, and that if we gave animals the mercy that we get, if we gave men the mercy that we show towards animals, that they'd put the kid out of his misery. and that Joffrey stole the blade from Robert's personal collection, gave it, hired this cat's paw to go and try to assassinate Bran because he thought that he's always, you know, Joffrey was insecure among his many other failings.
Mm-hmm.
And probably Robert being his dad didn't help out with that either. But he was trying to impress him, like, hey, I'm going to do the difficult thing that no one wants to do here, Dad.
Hmm.
That's what Jaime thinks. That's what Cersei thinks. That's what Tyrion thinks. But that also would explain why Littlefinger is kind of like, ugh, when he's talking to Bran about it, because the version that Littlefinger told is a big, giant lie.
That Tyrion had the dagger.
And he like, arguably, Cat seizing Tyrion is probably the proximal cause of the War of the Five Kings.
Okay.
I mean,
yeah.
You could argue Cersei killing
Ned,
Robert and Ned dying, but the thing that really, I mean, that's what caused the Lannisters to take up arms. That's what's caused Robb to be crowned King of the North.
Yeah.
That's the thing that kind of was the straw that broke the camel's back. So that's the best I can do as far as a chain of custody. I mean, in the books, I don't know. There was a note that I found there's a scene where Littlefinger's got Sansa, and he's explaining that he's going to hide her, and he's at his old family, the Baelish Tower, and the littlest of the fingers, and I guess he's eating fruit and slicing fruit with this dagger. I don't know how the hell he got it back.
Well, so
that's where the chain of custody breaks down.
At Winterfell, right? Like, I'm thinking. Maybe he heard about Maester Luwin's records and was like, oh, yeah, that knife is over there. Because doesn't he...
He does do that, but
isn't
he,
it
but
at Winterfell last?
Yeah, he has... Yeah, well, I mean, he gave it to Bran this episode.
Right. But before that, wouldn't it have been at Winterfell?
Well...
Maybe in the records? Like,
who
had it last?
Shit,
I don't remember.
Because Kat had it. She brought it to Ned. And I remember in the books, at least, Littlefinger's like, you should probably get rid of that because of reasons, which is, you know, in retrospect, seems pretty self-serving. And I can't remember if Ned actually absentmindedly handed it to him in the show. I can't. That's the thing I'm not clear on. But I mean, it's incontrovertible that Littlefinger eventually got the blade back because he gives it to Bran this episode.
Yeah.
And now we're talking about shit that's way past the book, so I don't have any like book details. Last I knew, in the books, he's slicing fruit while he's talking to the Sansa in his home.
Now Arya has it.
And now Arya has it, and isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
So there you go, Gabe. Eduardo, perhaps in an upcoming edition of your Spoiler podcast, you could discuss the role and purpose of the Three-Eyed Raven. I get that there's a Three-Eyed Raven. He was destroyed by the Night's King. Now, or the Night King... People really fucking get pissed when I call the Night King the Night's King, because that's a separate mythological creature character.
Suppose
possibly
in this,
related
in this podcast, that's appropriate, I guess.
Right, yeah. And it's the least fucked up thing my tongue will do this season, I guarantee you. Anyway, now Bran is the Three-Eyed Raven. All that being said, why does the Three-Eyed Raven even exist? What is his role and purpose? Do the other characters even know a Three-Eyed Raven exists now and historically? And what can he do? Any insights would be great. Unfortunately, Eduardo, this is one of the big central mysteries still. Like, in the books, Hodor is still alive, and Jojen is still alive, although there's a big popular theory that in actuality, Jojen dies of this wasting sickness that he's come down with.
It's a secret Targaryen.
And And because he's a secret Targaryen, he's got that royal blood. The Children of the Forest feed a paste that they make out of Bran's body and blood out of Jojen's body and blood to feed the Bran that awakens his essentially quickens Bran's green sing ability. So there's really not a lot to we know that the Three-Eyed Raven's. Something that's old. It's at least as old as Brendan Rivers, which we're talking about over a century. There's another big question is why, if the Three-Eyed Raven is kind of a central thing with the Children of the Forest, why isn't a Child of the Forest actually one the Three-Eyed Raven? Why is it this bastard Targaryen sitting on the Weirwood throne as it speaks? Is he you know, there's so many theories that take it and run with, like, well, maybe he's actually the ultimate evil. Maybe he's actually working for the others. But I have a problem with that because the Children of Forest would seem like the oldest and most mystical race in all of Westeros. How in the hell would they be fooled?
Yeah,
because they always seem to be the ones that are most on the anti-other side. Mm-hmm. So, like, everything I know about him from the books and the show seems to suggest that he is, like, humanity's faithful servant against the others, the White Walkers.
The old Three-Eyed Raven was bad at his job, because if his job is to... in as much as his job is to help protect the Children of the Forest, because
right.
they're all dead now,
right.
as far as we know.
And
the things he can do, we've right. seen on the screen, right?
But, like, we don't know, like, how do the Children of the Forest look at it? Because it could be that they yeah. feel like they're going to live forever through the Weirwood, so, like, their corporal
sure.
existence is not as important. But we know that's kind of bullshit, because at one point in their history, they cared enough about the corporal existence to create a race of mm-hmm. badass beings to try to kill all the First Men to save their asses.
Once you're a tree, you can't do much.
It's also interesting that the Three-Eyed Raven, like, initially reached out to Bran mm-hmm. because Jojen was already a more powerful Greenseer at the time, and he could walk.
Yeah.
He didn't have to be drugged to the fucking cave of the Three-Eyed Raven
sure.
by Jojen and Mira. So, like, if you're just wanting a powerful Greenseer, why not just beckon to Jojen and have him walk his ass up there?
Mm-hmm.
Is it important that Bran has a fairly unique ability that he can warg and Greensee?
It also seemed like Jojen, it took a toll on Jojen.
Right.
Like, for his visions. He would have seizures. His physical body almost couldn't handle the power.
In a way that Bran, even though he's physically crippled, seems stronger to take.
Right.
I don't know, because, like, I think there's a line in the book that's like, you know, like, 1 out of 1,000 men is a warg, and 1 out of 1,000 of those is a Greenseer.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, it's like, it's exceedingly rare to have the ability to warg and Greensee.
Yeah.
So... I don't know, but that's – and then the other question is, like, well, if you put aside those, maybe the reason he appealed to Bran is because now that we're seeing that it looks like Bran is going to be the one to spill the beans about the fact that Jon is this, you know, secret Targaryen, and he's probably
right.
the prince that was promised in Azor Ahai, that the Three-Eyed Raven wanted to make sure that he got the guy that would be in a position to most persuade Jon
mm-hmm.
and that he would believe him when he got this, like, revealed knowledge.
Sure.
Because he's got, you know, he can see all possible timelines. Like, that's more speculation. But honestly, Eduardo, we don't really know. These are some things that, like, us book readers are kind of, you know, playing right alongside of us. But we don't, it's not even clear how far back does Greenseer tradition. Is this one of the things that this, as soon as the First Men and the Children of the Forest sealed their deal, did, like, all right, give us one of your dudes, we're going to plug him into the Weirwood tree, and by the way, we'll need one about every 100 years. I don't know. I mean, fucking people forgotten why they built the wall at this stage. We're talking way ancient history.
Yeah.
All right, move on. Bobby, would it be the greatest troll of all time if Gurm came out with both Winds and Dream at the same time? Maybe he's taking so long to write Winds because he's actually been writing two or more books. I feel like this is the bargaining stage of grief.
Yeah.
It would be fucking awesome if he's, like, taking all this shit for the last 3 years and he just decided to release them as a double set.
Uh-huh.
But that seems like pure wish fulfillment on behalf of us book readers at this point. There's no evidence to hint that at all.
And
other than the fact that the fucker thought he was going to be done 3 years ago. He was 3 months away from being done 3 years ago, and he's gone essentially radio silent since.
We've already established what the greatest troll would be with the Stephanie Myers thing.
Yes, yes. The barrier has now been raised, Bobby.
Yeah.
It would destroy – it would break the internet if he just dropped it as a double book.
It would,
right before season – like, hey, you know, especially since we're not going to get Game of Thrones next, just like in the middle of the year, he's just like, boom, here's the final two books.
Yeah.
It's a double set.
And all promises are met. I did complete them before.
The Martins always repay their debts.
Right.
Fern from NYC, I have two question topics. What is known about the Raven system in the books? Is it a maesters only in castles capable of using it? Are there public Raven services, side of the road Raven stations? Any thoughts on the cost of one message, or a countersign and receipt, or a failure rate of sent messages? That's another thing we don't... So... the only information I was able to find that kind of touches on this is actually in one of the preview chapters for Winds of Winter, where Stannis is interrogating a maester that he's captured from Winterfell, and he's trying to figure out what Ramsay Bolton sent in his last raven. And
okay.
The maester's not, but he's interrogating him, and he asks, "A maester's raven flies to one place and one place only. Is that correct?" The maester mopped sweat from his brow with his sleeve. "Not entirely, Your Grace. Most, yes. Some few can be taught to fly between two castles. Such birds are greatly prized. And once in a very great while, we find a raven who can learn the names of three or four or five castles and fly to each upon command. Birds as clever as that come along only once in 100 years. Hmm. So the other thing I found in researching this on the Wiki of Ice and Fire is that apparently it's not just ravens that carry messages. There's like pigeons and doves, but they're not as smart, they're not as reliable, and they're not as sturdy. Like, you know, ravens are better at fighting off like eagles. They're more crafty about how they fly over land. One hobby of armies is shooting down ravens to disrupt communications.
Sure.
There's no hint at how much it costs. It doesn't seem like, again, you just put aside all commoners. You're not going to have like some fucking crofter from some fucking random village sending out a wedding announcement, all right? Because everyone that you meet that's not a highborn person is illiterate.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't know what to do with it if they did. It's not, this isn't class. This is just the reality of a medieval society.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed, I've always thought that the ravens was a maester system because it's always associated with them. The maesters are ones that care for them,
yeah,
that train them, that select them for their purposes, who write the messages and send them off. And it's the citadel that kind of like does, they do citadels, all, is the one that breeds the special white ravens that are used to communicate the change of seasons. It seems like it's something entirely provided by them, and if you don't have a maester, it's kind of like you're unplugged from that part of the network.
I feel like the maesters are one of the power centers.
They really
like,
are.
A serious power center in
they
the kingdom.
Really are. And they hide in plain sight by their humility. Like, you know,
sure,
the fact
yeah.
that, oh, we just serve the realm, and we just...
Right, like the know. High sparrow, right?
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, I'm just
exactly.
doing God, the will of the gods.
Right.
Isn't Bran technically like the ultimate enigma machine during like a siege or something?
Oh, yeah.
Because couldn't he warg right into a raven and just pull it down?
Sure,
like,
he could.
Oh, you're sending a message? I wonder what that says. Grab the raven.
I said in a preview podcast, like, I think one of the big roles that Bran has to play is the some sort of like crucial battlefield commander to like enable all the forces of good to stay in contact and have this intelligence. Because that does seem like, right or wrong, that that's something they're suggesting, the fact that like the intelligence systems have broken down in Westeros because mm-hmm. everyone knows what everyone's doing, or they don't know what anyone's doing. And like, you know, the most reliable networks have been taken over by hostile forces. And but yeah, he also wonders if there's any chance Littlefinger's on to Arya and the Faceless Man. He's ethnically Bravosi, as we talked about in, I think, the previous spoiler podcast, and might have grown up with tales of them. Also, he just see a young woman display herself to be a legit badass. That's an interesting theory. You're right. Baelish's grandfather was a Bravosi sellsword, and as we talked about last week, their family crest is the giant of Braavos.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be, especially if when she says, "No one taught me that," that would definitely perk up his ears if he's paying attention.
Yeah, that could.
That would explain why he's got that kind of disquieting. So maybe, I don't know, maybe he knows the secret, the defeating them, or like a way to fuck
those
up their faces.
Pink lips. Yep.
Big pink lips.
What? Yeah, he's going to put on the lipstick. He's just going to go kissing everybody.
Okay, we're talking about Cersei's Forever, Forever 21 lipstick she's
kiss.
Wearing.
Yeah.
Ryan, you know, the thing is, Arya knows how to deal with child molesters.
Yeah, she sure does.
She sure as fuck knows what to do with those fuckers.
Yep.
Ryan K., here's the question I think everyone wants to ask, but we've all overlooked so far. With over only 9 hours of television left in this TV show and clearly still the battle for the Iron Throne looming, what could we possibly learn about the White Walkers that we don't already know? Yes, it would be great to get a backstory on them besides how they were made, but in all honesty, I think the Double Ds are just going to use them as the last evil force the good guys must defeat. I know as a book reader and a Gurm fan, it's sad to admit this, but because these books have not been written, this is the most likely outcome we're going to get on this front. Another traditional fantasy story ending, and that's not what we signed up for.
Hmm.
I mean, so here's the other thing. I've heard that the next six episodes in season eight, the one thing that I have heard about them is that there's one that's got a planned runtime of an hour and a half.
Yeah, they're
and in fact that like it's been what I've heard that they're all kind of supersized Game of Thrones episodes.
Mm.
So it could be like almost getting seven, eight, possibly more actual seasons or actual episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like. Since we know nothing about it and there's and no expectations, I feel like there's a lot more room to, you know, and these are questions that people are already on their mind. There's a lot more room to introduce this stuff late without needing a previously on or anything like that, because it's just a totally new thing that we're all like I would put up with a lot of exposition,
mm-hmm.
a lot of like, and there's also have a mechanism where we've already seen the Night King infiltrating Bran's visions. Like, they already have a mechanism where they could kind of, like, talk and discuss and, like, figure out what their real deal is that wouldn't seem sure. like it's forced or out of place. Because,
mm-hmm.
And you know, this might be me holding on to the wish fulfillment angle, but I do think that's the one thing that would be disappointing is if the White Walkers are just this unknowable alien evil force that do nothing but cause death and devastation for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely anti-Game of Thrones story. So,
and you don't think they've given enough of a reason for that? I mean, well, with the Children of the Forest backstory and the reason they were mm-hmm. created, and I almost feel like they have given us that information about their motivations. They are just a killing machine, right? Like,
but
it comes into conflict, I think, when you talk about, okay, they're taking babies and the Craster stuff. Like,
right.
Clearly, they have some purpose beyond just killing.
Right, because, you know, they're... their purpose ended a long time ago when the Children of the Forest and the First Men created a peace accord to then combine together and defeat them. So I would like a little bit more nuance to what they're trying to do.
Okay.
You know, even if it's just like, hey, we're actually decent folks. We, you know, it's like there's a lot of theories, and you go back to our spoiler archive, we talk about like the Night King and the relationship of the Starks and Winterfell, and why they always say there must always be a Stark in Winterfell, and have since they've forgotten so much of this pact that they made with the Children of the Forest, like, is there something that the humanity is doing that's technically in violation?
Hmm.
You know, people point out that like the White Walkers started coming, you know, started beefing when you know, the Rangers are ranging north, and, you know, maybe like humans are supposed to stay on this side of the wall and the fucking wildlings are there and it's a provocation. I don't know. Like, it'd be interesting if there was some treaty that were in technical violation, and maybe we defeat them just by remembering what we want. Like, maybe we're supposed to give them like a bushel full of babies every 10 years or something. Like, and we haven't been doing it. Like,
yeah.
There's gotta be something there. That's my opinion anyway. Dayton from Austin, Texas. I've been rereading, and something from Danny's Dance with Dragons chapters caught my eye. You haven't talked in a while about the warning Danny receives from Quaithe to beware the perfumed seneschal. I think that's how you pronounce that name.
Hmm.
I know this doesn't appear in the show, but if it's fulfilled in later books, it might have an impact on the show, of course. I used the search for ice and fire to find the word perfumed, and lo and behold, our dear friend and advisor to Danny, Varys, is first described as being heavily perfumed. Could he be the perfumed essential that in the show? Could this mean betrayal, where Varys realizes that Dany may not be what's best for the realm? What are your thoughts?
What the hell is essential?
So essential is like an old-timey word that means kind of like a steward or a major domo, or essentially a very high-level administrative person in a noble house.
Okay.
So if you think steward, like the stewards of Gondor, the fact that the Tyrells were the stewards to the gardeners, that you're on the right position. And this is something that is get kicked about, because it's a prophecy, and not a prophecy. It's, you know, Quaithe is this mysterious figure that appears a couple times in Dany's life, and she's got this intricate jeweled mask, and she always says this weird enigmatic shit, and then she disappears again. But there's a couple candidates for who this could be. In the books, there's the character of Resnick Mo Resnack. Who is kind of the seneschal of Danny's court, and he has a penchant for wearing a lot of perfume. So he's literally, I mean, he's not referred to as a seneschal, but that's his position. Mm-hmm. Of course, as you said, Varys, you know, you could describe him as being a kind of a steward on the small council, mm-hmm. and he always wears perfume, and he's powdered, and he's very I guess manicured would be the word. There's also the ship that carries Tyrion Lannister and Jorah Mormont over to Essos is called the Selessori Quorhan, which is translated as the Fragrant Steward. That's literally the perfume essential. So this could actually be a warning about trusting Tyrion, or Jorah, for that matter.
Yeah.
Also, Archmaester Marwyn, which we've talked about, he's like, if I want to prick your memory about it, I've talked about him being the guy who trained Miri Maz Durr, who was the witch woman who cursed Dany and did black magic on Drogo. Mm-hmm. He also trained Qyburn in anatomy. And he's like he's referred to as the mage of the Citadel because he still believes in magic and he's still trying to make the glass candles glow and do all this shit. And he's last seen when he finds out that Dany's over there and she's got dragons. He boards a ship called the Cinnamon Wind, which would be fragrant. And now you're like, well, where's the Seneschal come in? Well, the Maesters every year elect a position called the Seneschal by essentially lots, because it's seen as a demotion, because you have to you spend all your time with the business of making the Citadel run, and you can't do your studies, and you can't do your research and all that.
Right.
And one of the speculations is we're going to find out that Marwyn was previously served as a Seneschal, so that he would be literally boarding a fragrant ship, and he's a Seneschal, and Dany should watch out for him. Those are the ones that are there's a couple more, but I kind of selected ones I thought were kind of serious. Like there's I can't remember what house, but there's this dude that farts a lot that's on Dany's small council.
Yep, Sir Farts a lot.
That's on Cersei's small council, and that's like he's a perfume seneschal, and I'm like that's a fucking joke suggestion. Get it out of here.
Yeah.
The thing is that prophecy's not in the books, but if you look at the short list of people that are actually on the show. You got Tyrion, you got Varys. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it seems like there's a case you could make for both of them. I wouldn't have said that about Tyrion until this episode, but boy, they really show a lot of conflict. But by the way Dany's vaporizing his men, the way she almost kills his brother, the fact that he still obviously cares about his brother. Mm-hmm. And then Varys, you know, all he has to do, he's already said it in the episode. Like, if I think that you're no longer serving the realm and you're going a little mad queenie, maybe I'll tell it to your face, but maybe I'll just fuck you.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that stand out to me. Naomi S., this is the last one. Do you think Benjen Stark might have a significant role to play in the upcoming War of the North? And do you think we'll ever see him again? It seems like they gave him enough significance in the early show to just abandon his character later. And we know he's still alive-ish, so maybe we'll have insight into the White Walkers. Man, I have a hard time touching this because I was so convinced that this whole Cold Hands and Benjen was just some bullshit. Mm-hmm. And then he came just like Euron Greyjoy, roaring back.
Sure did.
And I had to eat all my words. So it seems likely, like if you looked at the preseason trailers, that there is a group of dudes that go up with Jon to, you know, like, and if you, there's a lot of people drew parallels between The Last Hero with his group of 12, which also has a nice kind of, a nice ring to it, because you got Jesus and his 12 apostles. There's also the number 13's been significant in the books because it was the 13th Lord Commander that fell in love with another and that Lord Commander was a Stark. And, you know, there's like all this offsetting different like 12 and 13 symbolisms. It wouldn't blow me away if Benjen is in that party.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like the Hound, looks like the Thoros, looks like Beric is up there. Jon, I would put probably Brienne could be up there. Tormund, yeah, he's up. So like, it wouldn't surprise me to see him in that role. But is he significant to the plot? Is he going to be able to give them any insight into the White Walkers? I don't know.
Yeah,
I'd just be writing fan fiction. I try not to do that. I'll leave that up to the double D's.
Yeah.
So that's our spoiler podcast for the week. We will be back Sunday night after the latest episode with our instant take, and it starts to cycle all over again. We have to fight the long night to push back the others. Tuesday with the main podcast, and then Friday with the spoiler edition. And you can get into discussion at GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. There's also the forums, forums.baldmove.com, which is just rocking and rolling with speculation. If you like to talk about the leaks, there's a couple of clearly marked leak threads that you can, you know, get in there and talk with your fellow fans about. And as always, you can follow us on social instant media. instant social media, facebook.com/baldmove, @baldmove on Twitter and Instagram. Anything else you want to say in closing?
No, I think that's it. I'm excited for the next episode, though.
Three more episodes.
Get to find out what happens to Jamie, what happens to Bronn. I assume we get to find out those things.
You know, after seeing that video, I actually wondered if an unarmored person could haul
an armored person with
50 pounds strapped to
them.
That's
a good question.
Like, if they do it, I'm not going to, like, wait for the video to prove that you can't, but, like... Super. Yeah. By the way, all those links that I talked about are in the show notes. Sounds like we'll see you Sunday night. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.